Beetroot juice, used by Olympic athletes for its stamina-boosting effects, caused waves at the last Olympics. Clinical studies proved 2 glasses of beetroot juice per day could increase stamina by 16%. I've been using it, and this product is excellent. Beets are a nutrition goldmine, so call 800-738-2198 or go to intelligentbeets.com. Get a 30-day supply free. That's 800-738-2198 or intelligentbeets.com. Welcome back to the Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and we're doing sort of a potpourri today, giving you a smorgasbord of some of the important nutrition and health stories of the week. So settle back, and hopefully you'll learn something that is of relevance and importance to your life. All right. This study kind of buttresses something that I talked about a few months ago, and it's still a very, very popular blog. I wrote a story for Mind Body Green, and then again for our newsletter at drhoffman.com about all the benefits of eating nuts. And yet another study has come out supporting the benefits of eating nuts. And it's from the Journal of the American Medical Association. High nut consumption is associated with lower cardiovascular related and all-cause mortality. That's pretty good. Not only does it reduce heart disease, but it reduces death from all causes. And one of the first clues to this was a study they did in Seventh-day Adventists. Now, Seventh-day Adventists are generally vegetarian. They conveniently have a headquarters at Loma Linda University in Southern California. And they did a study there of the health patterns among Seventh-day Adventists who were vegetarians. And what they found was there were some Seventh-day Adventists who were vegetarians who ate a very low-fat diet and didn't eat any nuts because they're concerned about the fat in nuts. And then there were some who added the fat in nuts. And one might suspect, okay, they're on a higher-fat diet, they're eating nuts, and that can increase their risk of cardiovascular disease. Well, au contraire. It turned out the opposite, that even adding fats and presumably calories with the nuts reduce the incidence of cardiovascular disease in a large epidemiological study. Okay, this one is better because it's, you know, epidemiological studies look backward. This one looks at looked forward. They followed individuals who were quizzed as to their diet. And what they found was that all-cause mortality, all causes of death among people in the highest quarter of nut, peanut, and peanut butter intake was roughly 20% lower. This is good news for me because I consume a lot of nuts. And I do love peanuts and peanut butter. And it's got to be the pure stuff, just ground up peanuts, no additives. These individuals had a 20% lower risk of death than their peers who consumed less nuts. Cardiovascular-related death in the highest versus lowest nut intake quartiles was 23% lower in blacks, 38% lower in whites. Hey, it's even better for me because I'm white. They're got a nearly 40% lower in, risk, and 24% lower in Asian populations. They actually broke it down by race because, yeah, sometimes you know, one food or another based on genetics may have differential effects. And turns out that, like we said, nuts are good for you. We didn't know how good until this latest study. Pretty darn good. All right, this one's about another common dietary constituent, which is coffee. And, I tell you, when I came up through the ranks, we were telling everybody, get off coffee. It's bad for you. It makes you nervous, makes you hyper, stresses you out, drains your adrenals, et cetera. Makes your heart race, sends your blood pressures through the roof. And now, headline, moderate coffee consumption associated with lower coronary artery calcium scores. That's pretty cool. Again, the technique that we use to evaluate cardiovascular risk among some of our patients is to send them for a low radiation EBT scan, which uses the same technology that a bone density uses to look at calcium. Because actually, in a bone density, you're looking at calcium. And in a coronary artery scan, you're looking at calcium too. But in the bone density scan, you want more calcium. And in the coronary artery scan, you want less calcium. So what they found was that the lowest scores in calcium in the coronary blood vessels were found among those who had 3 or 4 cups of coffee daily. So they say the coffee drinkers had lower coronary artery calcium scores than did non-coffee drinkers. And they did not break this out as to whether the coffee consumers had regular coffee or decaffeinated coffee. I presume the vast majority of these 25,000 Korean adults were drinking regular coffee. It has actually been shown that coffee helps to prevent LDL cholesterol oxidation because those dark compounds in coffee are akin to the dark compounds that you find in wine and in chocolate and in berries. These are beneficial polyphenols. And so it is likely, but not entirely for sure, that decaffeinated coffee would impart at least most of the benefits of coffee. It's probably not the caffeine per se that is preventive, although caffeine has some helpful properties. It may reduce insulin resistance. It may have a detoxifying effect on the body. Other studies have shown that coffee can dramatically reduce the risk of liver disease in patients because it may help to detoxify the liver. And yes, there is that kind of bizarre tradition of coffee enemas. Well, maybe there is something to that, that coffee detoxifies the liver. But at any rate, this is pretty cool because they say this association is biologically plausible. Coffee contains antioxidant compounds that might lower cardiovascular risk. Okay, moving right along to another lifestyle-related consumption, which is alcohol. And, you know, I always get in trouble when I talk about alcohol on this program because usually there's somebody out there who is just thinks that I'm doing a tremendous disservice to the public by quoting studies that suggest that alcohol may have protective effects. And mostly until now, studies have shown that moderate alcohol consumption has protective effects, particularly when it comes to cardiovascular disease. And it may be the red wine compounds like resveratrol, but actually there's some protective effect that you find in even distilled alcohols like gin and vodka, which don't have any kind of polyphenol content whatsoever. All right. So here we go. The latest study, this was done, let's see where this was done. It was done, obviously, in a major medical journal, British Medical Journal. And, you know, they have to keep upgrading these studies because in some studies, former heavy drinkers who have poorer health than never drinkers were categorized as non-drinkers. Okay, you understand what's happening there? So you could be, you could enter a study as a non-drinker at the time of the study, but you were a former heavy drinker. And then you could have a bad health outcome and they could say, you see, non-drinkers die before drinkers. But no, these people may have skewed the... So they reassessed the relation between alcohol consumption and all-cause mortality in 53,000 adults who participated in the United Kingdom Health Survey. Now, that's a place where, man, you want to study alcohol and heavy alcohol consumption, that is the place to go. Because if you've ever been, you know, in a small town or certain parts of London on a Friday or Saturday night, man, oh, man, they are reeling. They're just lying in the streets, you know, hanging out over benches, puking in the alleys, you know, on a typical night in Glasgow or in Manchester. Certain working class parts of England, even upper class parts of England. Anyway, so compared with non-drinkers, alcohol consumption at levels ranging from one drink to less than 20 drinks weekly. Wow. was associated with significantly lower all-cause mortality in both age and sex groups. However, compared with never-drinkers, mortality benefits were significant only among younger men, age 50 to 64, who consumed 15 to 20 units weekly, or up to 1.5 units on the heaviest drinking day, and older women who consumed less than 10 units weekly. So what they're saying here, you know, it's numbers are a little confusing, but what they're saying here is these results actually call into question the widely held assumption that moderate alcohol consumption confers health benefits in most adults, because the benefits were not great once they adjusted and reassessed this study. They say now that there's dwindling evidence for a protective effect of alcohol. And certainly there are harmful effects of alcohol, including higher risk of stroke and cancer, but also higher risk of mayhem, depression, suicide, homicide, death by accident. Some of the recommendations for healthy diet, these little Mediterranean diet, they say, well, make sure you drink, you know, have one or two drinks per day. Well, maybe, just maybe. Certainly that's not a one-size-fits-all thing. It might be beneficial for some people. Some people may be able to handle it beautifully, and that's part of a healthy lifestyle for them. But according to the latest studies, the effect is not as robust as once thought. Okay, while we're looking at practical lifestyle recommendations, this is a very, boy, talk about an important question. Which is more important, exercise amount, i.e. duration, or exercise intensity, particularly when it comes to reductions in your belly fat? Wow, what a profound question. Okay, so they researched this issue in the Annals of Internal Medicine. To investigate this issue, researchers conducted a six-month trial in which 300 abdominally obese adults were randomized to one of four groups. So they had a control group that just did their thing. They maintained baseline activity level. They didn't alter their exercise habits at all. That's group number one. Group two was a low exercise group. They call it low-low, low amount and low intensity. So it was just 30 minutes of exercise at a low intensity. That's 50% of VO2 max. So VO2 max is something you can measure in a lab, and it means that you're not really out of breath. I mean, you can conduct a conversation while you're exercising. Then they had a high-low group. The duration was a lot, 60 minutes of exercise per day, I guess it is. But it was low intensity. Again, you know, they could, you know, like maybe walking on a treadmill or slowly pedaling on a bicycle, not too much. And then they had a high group, which had a high amount and high intensity, which got up to 75% of VO2 max. So they were huffing and puffing. And they did the basis on five sessions weekly so 5 out of 7 days they did either nothing or low-low or high-low or high-high. Here's what they found. At 24 weeks, that's six months, the average waist circumference was smaller by about 4 centimeters, what's it, about a couple of inches, and average weight loss was greater in the three exercise groups than in controls. So all the exercise groups lost weight. But really, neither of these outcomes differed across the exercise groups, kind of surprisingly. The only significant difference or benefit that the high-high group achieved is that they had lower two-hour glucose levels than did controls. And both the high-low and the high-high groups had better insulin sensitivity than did controls. So in other words, when it came to actual weight loss, just exercising, which is actually a reassuring message, because for some people it's too tedious or they're incapable of reaching that high thing. They just can't get around to doing that much exercise. They don't have enough endurance. So that should be encouraging for people desiring to lose belly fat. But the other part of the take-home message is that you do need probably higher duration or higher intensity or both to achieve the best blood sugar controls and insulin sensitivity controls. In other words, you're trying to combat type 2 diabetes. I mean, you can do it with just moderate amounts of low intensity exercise, but you're going to get a better result with a high intensity exercise. What they say here is these results do not provide any information that should alter current exercise guidelines. 75 minutes weekly of high-intensity exercise or 150 minutes weekly of low-intensity exercise. Take your pick. 150 minutes of weekly of low-intensity exercise translates to 30 minutes five days a week. And 75 minutes, that would be 25 minutes 3 days a week, but then it's got to be high intensity. So you and there is this notion of something called HIIT, high intensity interval training, where you don't have to spend as much time exercising and the benefits are equivalent. So that would square with this conclusion that they're virtually interchangeable. 75 minutes weekly of high intensity exercise or 150 minutes weekly of low intensity exercise are approximately equivalent in terms of their effects on your belly fat and possibly on your blood sugar. Interesting finding. Okay, let's tackle another one. This has to do with magnesium impact on physical performance of elderly women. Elderly, I'm sorry to say to you ladies out there that the definition of elderly is an average age of 71 and a half. Okay, that may be uncomfortably close for some of you. Small study, 139 healthy elderly women, average age 71 and a half. And what they wanted to assess was the impact of magnesium on their physical performance. And this study is very cool because they either got just 300 milligrams per day of magnesium or no supplemental magnesium. And after just 12 weeks, the magnesium group had a significantly better average score and significantly better chair stand-up time. Now, that's an interesting test because you can do this at home. You can see how easily you can stand up from a chair without using your hands. That's the trick. And that's really a very important test because your ability to stand up out of a chair without pushing down with your hands is a very good predictor of your risk of dying. If you have a lot of trouble and you really need to use your hands, you better get yourself in better physical condition because you are at higher risk of dying. It's not inevitable. I mean, there are people who have various types of handicaps, you know, pain or, you know, arthritis or something, and they might be sound in other parts of the body. But in general, that is a marker of physical conditioning. And with the magnesium, they were able to stand up and push off out of their chairs more easily, or not push off, just stand up on their own. And also their 4-meter walking speed was improved with the magnesium. The amount was 300 milligrams per day of elemental magnesium. And here's something that's kind of cool. It was the cheapest, most available, or most widely available form, not necessarily bioavailable, but most widely purveyed form of magnesium, which was magnesium oxide, which I recently changed my supplement foundation formula. It's out of production for a while, and some of you are complaining, but we've revised it to include a more bioavailable magnesium because we wanted it to deliver the right kind of magnesium, a premium magnesium. It's going to cost us more to make it. It's kind of a hassle. We had to source the special form of chelated magnesium. But in this study, magnesium oxide turned out it did the trick. Which is somewhat surprising because some studies have shown that it is less bioavailable. Some studies have found positive results in the treatment of a wide range of conditions, even when magnesium was taken in the oxide form. So it may not be the most effective magnesium supplement, but it's cheap and it's widely available. And it's also, per its weight, it contains more magnesium than certain other forms of more expensive premium forms of magnesium. So you may need to take less pills to achieve the result that you want. But it may be a trade-off because, you know, you could take less pills, but it will be less bioavailable. So taking whatever. So this study confirms that magnesium has an impact on physical performance, at least in older women who sometimes are challenged in terms of their physical performance. So if you're weak, wobbly, woozy, tired, you're having trouble with your workouts, just consider taking some additional magnesium, and it could be even magnesium oxide. Another problem, though, is magnesium oxide has a moderate laxative effect, and other forms of magnesium are easier on the stomach. So there are many people who, especially women, who say, when I take magnesium, it makes me go to the bathroom too much. So we have to give them other forms of magnesium that are less diarrhea-inducing, like jigsaw magnesium, which is the type of magnesium that we recommend at the Hoffman Center, or at least one of the magnesiums that we use. If you want to go to the bathroom, take magnesium citrate. It's a great laxative, but it is even less well-absorbed than magnesium oxide. So why does it work that way? Magnesium is a cofactor in energy production in the cell. And magnesium deficiency, one of the hallmarks of magnesium deficiency is that you feel weak and tired. All right, and finally, this one, which is a surprise because we didn't think of this nutrient in relationship to depression. This study shows that zinc increases the effect of antidepressant medication. They looked, again, a small study, 37 patients, age 18 to 55, the majority of them female with major depression, either received zinc sulfate or a placebo in addition to their medication, which was an SSRI, probably Prozac, Zoloft, Paxil, something along those lines. And what they found was that a supplementation with just this small dose of magnesium, 25 milligrams per day, enhanced the effect of the SSRI. These predominantly women had a better score in terms of their depression, in terms of their mood, when they took zinc along with their SSRI. So, you know, in some cases, these medications need to be used. Whenever an SSRI is used, I always urge patients to take lots of omega-3 fatty acids because of the antidepressant effect of EPA and DHA. I also urge patients to take methyl folate and methylcobalamin and B6 because these have, too, been shown to be like hamburger helper for SSRI medication, and especially patients who have defects in certain alleles of their MTHFR genes, which we now can detect on blood tests, routine blood tests or saliva tests, they have a greater need for methylated folic acid. And actually, if you go to a psychiatric convention, they actually have booths of companies that now make prescription B vitamins that they pitch to psychiatrists to give to patients with depression or dementia. And the idea being it's not that they're a substitution for the psychiatric meds, that they may enhance the efficacy of these psych meds. And so you can add zinc to fish oil and B vitamins as an add-on or an augmentation nutritional support helper for SSRI medications in patients with depression. Pretty cool stuff. All right, that wraps it up for this week's edition of Intelligent Medicine. Thank you for joining us. And from time to time, you know, this is kind of fun. We'll do a potpourri of some of the important nutrition stories of the week that we didn't get around to in our weekend edition of Intelligent Medicine, which is heard live on many radio stations across the country, or you can listen via live stream at drhoffman.com. Just click on the Listen Live button under our weekend radio show, our weekly radio show, and that is heard from noon to 2 p.m. Eastern time. So wherever in the world you are, you can always catch a live stream, or you can always, you know, if you miss it, check out the podcast, which is usually posted by midday Monday. Thanks again for joining us. I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman. Until next time, this is the Intelligent Medicine Podcast.